Bridget Muir is one of many to succumb to the lure of the world's highest mountain. Today she flew out of Melbourne, determined to claim the title of first Australian woman to conquer the highest mountain on Earth.
I'm pretty excited. What else can I say? I'm going to climb the highest mountain in the world.
Mrs. Muir reached the 8,848 metre summit by the Nepalese southeast side of the mountain.
Australia's only woman to conquer the world's highest peak recorded her victory on a tiny video camera to give people back home a unique look at history in the making.
Bridget Muir, the first Australian woman to climb Mount Everest. In fact, she's scaled just about the highest peak in every continent of the world. It sounds like a fantastic life of adventure, and I can imagine that she's seen some fantastic things that I will never see and you and I may never see in our lives. It's certainly one that can feel quite foreign to us if we're not mountain climbers ourselves. But to bring it back into context, when Bridget is not overseas ascending dizzying peaks, she calls Natimuk home, and it's for that reason that we do have the opportunity to speak to Bridget this morning. She joins me in the studio. Bridget, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
Now, as well as your fantastic accomplishments, this is also a period of time for mountain climbing where it's in the news for the wrong reasons as well. Last week we heard the tragic news about the death of Dr. Maria Stridham, a 34-year-old finance lecturer at Monash University in Melbourne who died trying to climb Mount Everest. Another climber in her group, Dutchman Eric Arnold, also died from altitude sickness over the weekend after reaching the summit on his fifth attempt. What was your reaction as someone who's done this and accomplished it? What was your reaction to the news?
Well, the first thing I thought was two members in the same group. Uh-oh, red alert. Something wasn't happening quite right there. Altitude sickness, which is the reason that was pointed out for their deaths, doesn't happen like that. It doesn't jump on you. It takes time to develop. So, you know, as they're part of a commercial expedition, and this is something I did for a very long time. I was the leader of expeditions climbing mountains at high altitude, and as a leader, it is your duty to keep an eye on people and make sure that they are doing all right, because altitude sickness does kill.
But it, as you say, it was raising alarm bells with you that two in the same group. So why was that alarming to you?
Well, because that meant that they obviously, first of all, didn't have the experience to deal with the signs and symptoms themselves. I climb high mountains for over 30 years, and let me tell you, you do find out what your body can and cannot do. But that only comes from experience and going to high altitude a lot. And it seems to me that these days, people think that if they want to climb the seven summits, and they've done a couple of them and perhaps have gone up to 7,000 meters, yay, they train and they're ready to go for the big one, for Mount Everest, the highest summit in Asia. But that is not the case. You really need to put in the time and energy to get to know more about how things work, especially for yourself.
And given the rates of people perishing on the climb, particularly Everest, do you believe that that training and preparation is something that people are not doing?
They are training, as in fitness training, but they are not putting the time to get the experience at high altitudes. I do mentor a couple of ladies who want to climb the seven summits, and my recommendations to them is, first of all, get a good basis, do a really good mountaineering course so you know actually how to survive in the mountains, but also get experience at altitude. Go to other high summits, over 7,000, over 8,000 meters, so you can actually get experience at dealing with an oxygen system, because these days on 8,000 meter peaks people use oxygen, which is not what used to happen in the past. So perhaps it was also a good thing, because without oxygen, you know much better what's happening in your body, so you can plan accordingly.
You are someone who you turned back a few times before you reached the summit of Everest. And in this instance, these are people who have suffered and died from altitude sickness because they were close to the summit but didn't turn back. So is that also an issue here, that do you think because of the cost and the effort associated to getting to that point, people are reluctant to turn back when their own safety is in jeopardy?
I would say that the first factor is that they are not experienced enough to know when to turn back. And you said the expensive trips. Yes, they are. $30,000 is probably the least you can pay to go to Mount Everest. And it might be okay to go on a trip which doesn't offer everything that, you know, is offered on bigger expedition and better expeditions, such as very experienced Sherpas, Western guides, more oxygen, maybe better food and better medical attention, and also an organized system for getting people down in time if things go wrong. So it's how much you want to spend to stay alive. But if people don't have the experience to ask the right questions, that they can get into trouble, that's for sure.
So this is the fundamental that you're that it's coming down to, is experience.
Experience, and I believe it's very important to bring it back to personal responsibility. To me, the beauty and the joy of climbing mountains, and especially at high altitudes, is the freedom that it gives people, the freedom to make their own decisions. And of course, if you don't have the experience to make the right decisions, you may get yourself into trouble and pay very dearly for it.
You have been to Nepal a number of times. How experienced are the people that you have encountered near Everest? Have you, for instance, ever met people and been tempted to tell them don't try it because you can see that they're not experienced enough?
I have been on expeditions which were organized for people with experience. But at the same time, on those trips, there were people who didn't have much of a clue of what was going on. And that was, you have to remember, that was 20 years ago now. So perhaps there was less awareness on, you know, what needs to happen before you say yes to someone to get on a trip. And in fact, in 1996, there was a big disaster on Everest when 8 people died going to the summit, arriving too late and coming down in a storm. And I was actually in the middle of that. I was on the South Col when all that happened. So I really had, you know, first experience on everything that happened there. And that is really something that struck me many times. Yes, not just that time, but also other times on other mountains, that some people really shouldn't be there.
Is there also... it's easy to forget that you climb the mountain, you get to the peak, but then you've got to climb back down. Is that something that you've encountered mountaineers, climbers, who maybe don't factor that into their preparations as well? Again, coming back to that lack of experience about the effort that it takes to climb back down the mountain once you've accomplished your goal of reaching the peak?
I haven't been with people who were in that situation on Everest. I have been with people who were on that situation on other mountains that I was guiding. And yes, they don't think about it because it doesn't even enter their head. People get what is called summit fever. They just think summit, 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 and nothing else. And of course, it's only half the job done getting to the summit. You also have to come back down in one piece. But yes, if you don't have the experience, you don't notice it. And that's when you rely on your leader to tell you when to turn back. In the case of Maria Strydom, my feeling is that looking at the footage from, you know, the press coverage, which has been ridiculous, it's been everywhere for the last week, they didn't have any oxygen getting to the South Col. So my feeling is that perhaps she already had altitude sickness when she got to the South Col. Then you've got a night there at a new altitude, which is very high, of course, 8,000 meters. And then you start climbing another 1,000 meters vertical towards the summit. So if you start with already, you know, a core of altitude sickness, it's not going to get better, it's going to get worse. And it's not always obvious. For example, if you get HAPE, which is high altitude pulmonary edema, you don't get headaches, but you get breathless and you get really weak because you can't breathe. And even if you're breathing in oxygen, it doesn't really get to you.
You mentioned the media coverage of this, of the death of particularly Dr. Maria Strydom. Your word was ridiculous. In what way do you mean that?
I think the mainstream media loves disasters and people suffering. And I really, really feel for the families of people who die on mountain in these conditions. All that media attention, it's not healthy. I mean, mention what happened and try to analyze it, but make it into a huge news item and only concentrate on the negative side of it. It's not constructive. And if anything good has to come out of it, I would say that hopefully it will make people who want to go and climb Everest aware of the dangers, which are significant, and will also allow them to prepare for it, which means get to high altitude. Spend your money getting the experience at high altitude before you go and spend money on the mountain, which may kill you if you're not prepared enough.
And we are here talking specifically really about these latest deaths, Dr. Mm-hmm. Maria Stridham's in particular, that we heard of last weekend. A lot in the media, as we're talking about that, was put down to the altitude sickness was appropriated to the fact she was vegan. Diet obviously comes into it for being anyone in as an athlete in an extreme sport or otherwise. How much do you lend to that belief that it had something to do with her veganism?
Not a lot at all. When you think of it, a lot of Nepali people are vegan simply because they can afford to eat meat. When I climbed Everest, my main diet was champa, which is a porridge of roasted barley flour. And tea, coffee, hot drinks, a lot of hot drinks. And once again, because people in Nepal don't have much money, they might not even put milk in their tea. So, you know, being vegan is not a problem as long as you feed your body, and hydration is the main thing. So drinking a lot and getting proteins in is what matters.
Also, the excuse that was given about why Maria didn't stop overnight or didn't want to stop overnight. You talk of the summit fever, about only being interested in the summer, but the excuse that was given was because it would make the ascent more difficult, or even the descent on their way back down. They were looking at their timeline. Is that your experience as well, that sometimes you need to push on past what you would otherwise want to because of conditions?
If you are on a commercial expedition on a guided trip like they were, the leader is the one in charge, and the leader needs to know what's happening to each of the members. That's as simple as that. In this case, well, you know, I haven't got all the facts in hand, so I cannot really comment. But my feeling is that that wasn't the case, because I've heard from friends who were guiding on Everest that it was an outfitter that was way under-resourced and employing Sherpas without experience, or without as much experience as others employed by more expensive trips. And it's always the same, you know. When you've got a skill, such as being a really good high-altitude Sherpa, you've got to be snatched by people who are prepared to offer more money for it. And as a client, you have to be able to decide what expedition to match to your level of expertise. And in this particular case, I don't think that was taken in consideration. Lack of information, I'm not sure. You don't have all the facts, and you can only deal with the results. And as I said before, hopefully these terrible, terrible results will teach other people what to do from now on.
I'm eager to talk broadly about mountain climbing as well with you. It's a good jump-off point, because I'm eager to get the terminology right here. Do you describe mountain climbing, particularly in such extreme environments, as a sport? Because if it is, then it's easy to have a perception of a sport as something that's easily accessible and accessible to everyone.
It may be the case now, although when I was climbing, it definitely wasn't a sport. It was, for me, it was my life. It was a lifestyle. I lived for a high altitude climbing. And in fact, I stopped high altitude climbing when in 1999 I was on a mountain called Makalu, which is the fifth highest mountain in the world. And I was there without Sherpas and without oxygen, because after Everest I thought it'd be great to be in a mountain where it's just like I used to climb mountains, without all that hoo-ha and depending on other people and oxygen. And unfortunately, on that mountain, a very close friend of mine was killed coming down from the summit. I was at base camp at the time, and I stopped climbing. I left all my gear on the mountain and I went home. And that was, I guess, the first time that I'd lost someone I loved to a mountain. So I think that really puts me in a position to understand how parents and families and friends feel about what happens when people get killed at high altitude. The sport factor, well, it was probably a sport already in those days, 20 years ago, and I think we mountain climbers used to call those people peak baggers. I don't know what they're called these days, but yeah, it's an activity which puts you out there, you know, and it allows you to push your limits mentally, physically, in any way, and it's also quantifiable. You know, when you say I've climbed Everest, that people will know what you're talking about.
It's also for these countries, the countries in which the seven summits are, but Everest included in Nepal. It's the tourism industry is important to their economy. How do these deaths in the last few days, in these weeks that we see seemingly regular occurrence on these mountains, Everest in particular, how does that impact the tourism industry over there?
I don't think it does at all. Everest is the tallest mountain on the planet, so people will always want to climb it. There are a lot more people climbing it these days, so you have to take that in consideration when you say that a lot of people die climbing it. And the reason that some people die climbing it is also because of the number of people who want to climb it. You need more Sherpas working on trips because, you know, for one person wanting to climb the mountain, you might have three or four people, Nepali people, working on the mountain. And that means that there are only so many experienced people who can work on mountains. And so the cheaper outfitters will rely on people without much experience. And it's all very well to learn while you're doing it, but when the proverbial hits the fan, if you don't have the experience to deal with that, it's a recipe for disaster.
For climbers who travel to a country like Nepal to scale Everest, it is about choice. We touch on Sherpas, and the climbers are in that country to pursue the goal, but what often isn't addressed are the locals who accompany those climbers, the Sherpas of Nepal in this instance. There's been some discussion also in the media that mountain climbing is at worst a selfish act, putting pressure on impoverished locals to indulge in someone else's dangerous ambition. How would you respond to that, Brigitte?
Climbing mountain has been part of the local economy in Nepal for a very long time. It started really in the 50s, and it's very good for the economy. It's not just mountain climbing, it's also people who go trekking. And the country has changed enormously in the Everest area. It's a lot more wealthy than it used to be, and that's only because people come there, and that means that the local people can make more money. You know, they can make the amount of money that they make in a month's time on a mountain would probably be the equivalent of what they would make working for local people over a year. So it's not a bad thing at all. It's very good for the economy. But what is important is to make sure that the local people who get themselves into climbing jobs have the right skills and experience behind them to be able to not only do their job well, but also come back alive, because Sherpas also die on mountains more often than Westerners.
You have begun a community project in Nepal that's centered around locals. What's that about?
Well, I was guiding in 2005 in Tibet, taking a trip to the Lola, which is the pass at the bottom of the north face of Everest, and working with, of course, local Nepali people. And I became very good friends with one of them called Lakpa Tamang. And he was someone who was always laughing on the trips. And that's what most of the local people do on trips. They're always so happy. And I wanted to know if that was the case when they were back home. So I had that little phrase pop into my head, beyond the smile. I wanted to go beyond the smile and to see what was happening back home. So Lakpa invited me to go to his village and to meet his family. And I did so in 2007, and I started filming. So I've been working on a documentary ever since, collecting footage each time I was in Nepal working and then going over to their village. And also I realized while I was there that this was a very small subsistence farming community, and the women couldn't read and write in their own language, Nepali. So I started a fundraising program to allow them to do so. First of all, of course, we had a meeting with the women of the village and asked them, do you want to read and write? And they said yes. So I got the money for them to do courses, and then they went on to empowerment, and now we're looking at a nursery for trees to reforest the slopes about the village, because of course there's danger of landslides, especially with earthquakes coming on a regular basis, and also looking at local kids who go to school and their parents spend a lot of money sending them to school, but most of them, 90% of them, actually don't finish school. So what do you do with all those local kids with skills and nowhere to go? That's what I'm interested in. Creating local jobs, sustainable local jobs, such as in permaculture, for example, or solar power installation, whatever they're interested in and whatever is possible, to look at a better future for those villages and to keep the people in the villages instead of having them go overseas or to Kathmandu in, you know, searching for the elusive dollar or rupee in this case.
Sure. So we can anticipate that all of that collection of footage to come together into that documentary film before too long.
Yes, I hope so. I'm just about to start another crowdfunding exercise, so if people are interested, they should go and visit my website, which is beyondthesmile.net, and there's a lot of information there.
Well, Brigitte, thank you so much for stopping by and having a chat. It's certainly meeting one of the greats when you speak to the first Australian woman to ever climb not only Everest but the seven summits in total, and you're the perfect person to really get a sense of your experience and perhaps the lack of experience in some of these cases of unfortunate tragic deaths that we're seeing particularly on Everest as well.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
That is Brigitte Muir, as I say, the first Australian woman to climb Mount Everest. In fact, she's scaled just about every high peak in every continent. She's the first Australian to scale the seven summits, the highest on each continent. And it might sound like a foreign concept. It might sound like a world away. But when she's not overseas ascending these peaks, she calls Natimuk home. And we appreciate Brigitte's time on the program this morning.